All right. Hello and welcome to yet another Value Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Walker. And with me today, I'm happy to have on for the second time, Mike Melby. Mike is a founder and portfolio manager at Gate City Capital. Mike, how's it going?
Hey, doing well. Thanks again for having me. Excited to be here.
Hey, excited to have you on for the second time. And you know, since it's your second time, you know, I start every podcast by pitching you my guest. Guests can go back to the first podcast to hear the full pitch, but I will say, you know, just to add on to that, I will say you're one of the most requested repeat guests, which is kind of surprising because the first stock we talked about was $100 million kind of little land bank out in Arizona, but it's double since we talked about 6 months ago. So maybe that's why you're so popular. But look, I enjoyed the last pitch. I'm really looking forward to this one, and I'm just happy to have you back on. So that out the way, the company we're talking about today, it's Cato Corp. The ticker is C-A-T-O. I'll just give a blanket disclaimer. This is a little under $400 million market cap company. That's very small. So everyone should remember, not investing advice. Please do your own research. Remember, very small. So you need to be careful with this. But that all said, I'll just flip it over to you. Who is Cato and why are we so interested in them?
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Cato is a retailer of women's fashion clothing. They operate 1,300 stores in the United States through three, I guess, separate concepts. One is Cato, one is It's Fashion, and the final one is Versona. They're a no-frills retailer, all private label merchandise. Again, 1,300 stores focused in the southern and southeastern United States. And they've taken an approach that our shoppers, our customers, are going to shop in the store. Only about 5% of their sales go through the online channel. But very long history. Stores have been profitable consistently. As you see, a lot of retailers go in and out of favor. They've been consistently profitable, generated good free cash flows, and returned a lot of capital to shareholders, which I think we can touch on later as well. But what we're seeing now through the pandemic and maintained a very strong balance sheet is, as Andrew mentioned, a market cap right around $360 million, over $180 million in cash and marketable securities. They're also getting back an additional $33 million through prior income tax refunds from the CARES Act. So we're looking at an enterprise value of around $150 million. We've got them generating well over $50 million of EBITDA. We think a lot of that goes to free cash flow. And at our core, we're deep value investors and margin of safety investors. And generally look for companies with some sort of real assets, as we talked about AMREP last time with a big land holding in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. But Cato, while they lease all their stores, they own their corporate headquarters and distribution center. They're located in Charlotte, have 600,000 square feet of space, around 150,000 square feet of office space, 450,000 square feet of distribution space. We think that has significant value. And they also own 350 acres of land in a southern suburb of Charlotte called Fort Mill, South Carolina. It's called the Southbridge Development. They've partnered with a local developer, have constructed one commercial building on that, still have about 335,000 square feet to go. And it's a very popular area. We're seeing a lot of activity there. A couple companies looked at it and passed for big corporate headquarters, including the Carolina Panthers. Centene Corporation also looked at it. And we think it's a matter of time before they're able to monetize that for significant value. And finally, they own a 185-acre parcel of industrial land in another southern suburb of Charlotte. We think that has a good amount of value, too. We value it at around $10 million. And we think if the company doesn't sell that, that can be used for a future distribution facility while they could look to monetize some of their Charlotte land and buildings there. So overall, we see the retail space really opening up, and people are looking to get out and go shop. And one of the subsets Cato caters to is plus size women. And we think with a fair amount of potential weight gain or even weight loss during the pandemic, that people are going to look out and try to get new fashions and clothes that don't remind them of being inside. So at a high level view, we see a company with an extremely strong balance sheet in the retail space. They're not going anywhere. Right around $150 million enterprise value when you take out their income tax receivable, and generating north of $50 million in EBITDA, and we think well north of $30 million in free cash flow. So that's kind of a summary of why we like it and who they are.
No, look, that's a great overview. And I guess I have two comments on it. First, you mentioned the weight gain in COVID, and I'm very familiar with that part of COVID. But second, this is why you're the people's one of their most requested guests. Because look, yesterday I flipped through the 10K. I put together some notes and stuff. I read about the real estate, and I was kind of like, oh, this is an older company. I'm sure the real estate, they don't own their stores. I'm sure it's negligible. And you're coming out here and hitting me with tens of millions of dollars in potential some of the parts value there. So I want to dive into a couple different things, but let's start with Cato, the retail side. The first thing, I believe the first word in their 10K is they target the junior / missy side as well as the plus size. And it just strikes me as a little bit strange to target junior, missy, and plus size women. Am I looking at that correctly? Was I reading that right?
Yeah, it's that's correct. And just visiting their stores, it's kind of split up half and half. And so you have half the store that's more junior, missy, which is primarily focused more at I guess the younger demographic, and the other side is more for plus sizes. And in terms of the store base, and maybe just going back to their strategy again, they've operated for 50 plus years. They focus on strip centers, and so the whole mall concept is a big focus in retail right now. And right around 6 or 7% of their stores are actually located in mall. The vast majority are located in strip centers, with about 50% of their stores being located near a Walmart. Yep. Or in a Walmart strip center. And so I think caters well to who their target market is, which is probably at the lower end of the income side. All private label clothes. Just perusing through the stores, a lot of materials in kind of the $15 to $35 price range. And so I think they've done a good job of focusing on their on the demographic that fits them best, and not trying to be too much else. So I think it's a very frugal concept. They're focused on making money. And in terms of stores, there's a store manager, two assistant managers, and then a handful of part-time help. And they've cut back a lot during the pandemic as well. And so their total employee count went from 10,000 employees down to 7,500 employees. And so we think they've probably found some ways to operate more efficiently than they have in the past. But yeah, going back to the target market, lower end on the demographic and income side, we think that probably caters more to a less online crowd as well. And generally in smaller markets where women don't have a lot of options to shop, again, located oftentimes by Walmart, where their product's going to be significantly more fashionable than Walmart, but it is much better value point than your mall-based retailer. So I think going back to your question, those are kind of the target customers with the interesting opening line of the 10K.
No, that's perfect. You beat me to my next question. The majority or a lot of their stores are kind of focused or next to Walmart, which is perfect. So you can kind of understand their target market a little more. I guess my next question would be, so keeping in mind, Cato, it's still a controlled company. The CEO, he's obviously not the founder. I think he's the grandson of the founder, if I'm remembering. But he is 70 years old. And when I think family-controlled retailer, 70-year-old CEO at the helm, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is a lot of these guys are slow to move into the future. You know, I think Dillard's, which didn't really have an online strategy, even though that somehow became a meme stock. These guys, less than 5% of their sales are online. And you could look at it two ways, right? I think the nice way to look at it would be they don't have a great brand, a lot of online distribution. And so they're just playing in places where they can make money. It's smart not to do this. The other way you could look at it is, hey, online is the future. They've got a 70-year-old CEO. It's kind of tired, stale store base. And they're not really making that investment because it's not what he wants to do. This is what happens with older family controlled mall companies. So I guess I threw a lot out there at you, but if you could just kind of comment on overarching how you look at both the lack of online sales and the family controlled aspect.
Yeah. So just on the family controlled aspect. John Cato controls 40% of the voting shares through around a 12% economic interest. And so there are two classes of shares, and the stake he owns has 10 times voting rights. And so while it's not centrally controlled with 48% for all purposes, he controls the company. I think there are several ways to approach it. And I think the way the companies approach it, and maybe they're behind it, maybe they made a huge misstep here, but they're focused on ways to make money. And I think with the significant economic interest of John Cato, that he wants to make money and he's not interested in doing investments in technology that doesn't generate a return. And so they do have an online presence. You can go to cato.com or persona.com, which Persona is more of an accessory store than is their mall-based concept in a higher level income consumer. But right around 100 Persona stores, just for background there. They'll sell online, but they don't want to have it degrade their profit margins. And so I think going forward, they'll do what they think makes them the most money in the current environment. Their customers like the shopping experience. They like being in store. And they try to make it a store where it's a social activity. And again, a lot of their stores are in locations where you don't have a lot of options, try to coordinate the store so you can pick out a full outfit. And we'll see how kind of spending goes in terms of apparel purchases going forward. But it is always helpful to try clothes on to see how it looks, to make sure it looks the way you think it looks. And I think from a Walmart standpoint too, a big amount of their customers are going into the store and shopping physically in the area. So overall, I think it's a space where the company does not want to invest in things that make them less money and subsidize the online experience for the in-person experience. And historically, it's been a very profitable mode for them. And I guess going forward as well, a lot of we think they've been able to renegotiate the leases on a lot of their locations. Leases run from 1 to 5 years. And in the event that a store is not profitable, average lease is between 2.5 to 3 years, and they're coming due each year. We think the company can migrate out of that fixed cost base if it's no longer profitable for them. We don't see that happening right now, but they've kept their flexibility open in terms of fixed costs. They're not 10-year high rent areas that they're going to be stuck in for a long time. So we think that mitigates some of the risk there too. And in the meantime, they're generating a lot of cash from these locations.
Perfect. We'll come back to management in a second, but let me ask you about that fixed cost store base, because one of the things I noticed when reading the 10K, they peaked at just under 1,400 stores in 2016. That drops down from, it was 1,372, I think is the actual number. Drops to 1,281 by the end of 2019. So actually pre-COVID, they've cut 100 stores. You know, that's more than 5% of their store base. This is relatively meaningful. But in the past year, it looks like they've net opened about 50 stores, which I was surprised. You know, the past year includes the COVID area. So they were kind of expanding during COVID. And one of the cool things about this company and a lot of microcap companies, there's not a lot out there on there, right? Like they don't do investor calls. They don't have investor presentations. So I'm only pulling this from the 10K to say this, and they don't give a lot of description. So I'm wondering for you, like, how do you look at the store base, at how it's evolved, you know, first shrinking for 5 years and kind of growing over the past year?
Yeah, we think over the time, the company will continue to look to grow their store base and should be able to take advantage of a lot of competitors that have closed up shop in their key areas and in attractive rent areas. But for our assumptions going forward, we have the store base staying right around 1,300 stores, which may be a bit conservative. As you mentioned, they increased their store count in 2020, and that was due to commitments made prior to COVID.
And so it was pre-COVID commitments. They were actually planning to expand pre-COVID.
They were, exactly. And they put those expansion plans on hold. I think they just want to get on a little firmer footing in terms of expectations on the store model and also see what opportunities become available. They're looking to close around 25 stores in this fiscal year. So we think that'll come down a bit and then likely look to grow it over time. And so we assume a flat store base. I think the company feels that there's stores and locations they can expand to that are profitable, but want to be a little sure on the COVID environment and where we are at coming out of the pandemic before committing to more store expansion. So we've got, I'm seeing right around 1,300 stores, but I think there's upside potential there.
That makes sense. Well, let me turn back to management here, because one of the things I'm really impressed by, there were so many companies that shut off the share repurchase programs during COVID and just haven't come close to turning back on, especially physical-based retail companies. And this company, I think at the height of COVID, they paused it, but they got pretty aggressive with their repurchase towards the end of last year and start of this year. They're buying back a lot of shares. So I look at this company again, I look and I say, hey, these guys are not afraid to step into a share price that is pretty low and say, let's retire shares, even though the environment is very uncertain and very rocky. And I think that's going to turn out to be a great investment. But the counter is, you know, I come back to the CEO, I'm like, hey, this guy, he's willing to shrink the store base from 2016 to 2019 when the stores might not be profitable. He's willing to buy back shares at the height of uncertainty, but at the same time, he doesn't have an online presence. And, you know, I think if you look at the companies that I was just comping in some indexes, you know, they've way underperformed. He took over as CEO in May 1999. I think they've way underperformed the Russell over that 21-year period. So again, I'm of two minds here. So could you kind of touch on both the share repurchase program and how you're looking at the history of this company's management?
Yeah, and the share repurchase program, they've been, while the stock price has not performed well over his reign, they have been very active in returning capital to shareholders. And we tracked it going back to 2009, the company's returned $350 million in dividends. So I think as you look about share price performance, it is good to add back the $350 million in dividends over 12 years, which is a return. And maybe it is a total return calculation, but sometimes
I thought I returned it, but you know, who knows?
You probably did. But they've bought back $200 million right around there in stock over that time. And to your point, they were really aggressive last year in terms of repurchasing shares. They repurchased almost $20 million of stock at under $10 a share. And this was at a time when sales were still down 20%. And there was still, as there is today, a large amount of uncertainty on the COVID environment. And I think going into the pandemic, where so many retailers have failed, they went into the pandemic with almost $200 million of cash and securities on the balance sheet. And I think from a flexibility standpoint, even when generating all that cash and returning it to shareholders, that they've been able to utilize the significant flexibility that both their asset base and their cash base provides to take a contrarian view when others not as positive on the long-term outlook. So from a share repurchase or a capital allocation standpoint, I think recently it's been contrarian and is very value accretive. And just in Q1, which ends at the end of April, they repurchased another $5 million of stock, which is significant with their market cap and enterprise value. And we think that'll all be value accretive to shareholders. And I lost the second part of your question, I guess, just in terms of managing through the cycle. I think they focus on what they're good at. And there have been a lot of retailers that have done poorly and a lot of their peers that are no longer around. And so I think they've built the company for long-term success. They were certainly hurt by the COVID pandemic with sales in Q2 falling well over 50%. And more than 20% last year. Despite all that, they just lost operating cash flow. They lost $30 million last year, which is, I think, a pretty amazing achievement given how their industry was decimated. And I think have set themselves up well here going forward. You mentioned in 2016 to 2018 how they closed stores, and that was a time when the company struggled from a profitability standpoint, and they blamed it on a switch from being focused on kind of the target market we talked about before to really catering to women with a smaller build. And so they repositioned their clothes and their assortment to be more geared to a millennial type buyer. And that really hurt their sales. It alienated their core customer. They saw comps decline at a high single digit rate, and their profitability really contracted. And I think to their credit, they recognized that approach was wrong. They brought in, they brought back their old vendors. They started sourcing again to target the demographic that liked them best. And so in 2019, or the fiscal year right before the pandemic, comps were again positive. And I think they had, again, figured out who they were, and to their credit, were able to transition back to serve their target customer. And I think they're focused right there right now. So, the years 2016 to 2018 were rough years, and they closed stores as a result. But going back to the beginning of 2020, they felt at that time that they had the model figured out again, that they could grow their store base profitably, and were planning to do that. And then everyone kind of hit the big pandemic roadblock. But we think they're by that now.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. And it's funny because everybody wants to capture the millennial audience and get bigger. But you say, hey, we're Cato. We target plus size women, and we're in strip malls next to Walmart. You're like, we're going to switch to millennial buyers. You kind of look at the shirt and say, oh, maybe you company, Cato company, who doesn't have an online presence, maybe you're not the right person to go after millennials. So seems easy in hindsight, but good for them for shutting it down. Let's go over to, so you mentioned I'm just using your numbers from the beginning, $360 million market cap, about $180 million in cash, brings you to $180 million EV. Plus you get another $30 million tax credit, which would take you down to $150 million EV. And again, I read through the 10K and I kind of just dismissed the land, but based on what you were saying earlier, that land in Charlotte, I mean, Charlotte is a growth area. I like that city. I've tried to talk my wife into moving there, and she's told me, Andrew, you've only spent a couple hours there. You can't know you want to move there, but you know, that land's obviously super valuable. So how are you looking at that land? And maybe we can just use that to roll into a sum of the parts for Cato.
Yeah, exactly. Just in terms of both their headquarters and their distribution facility, we don't ascribe any additional value to that when we're thinking about the fair value of the company. The tax assessed value of those 600,000 square feet is right around $25 million.
The headquarters, 600,000 square feet?
That's right. And we think that's we think that's too low. So we think fair value is probably closer to $50 million. Now that is needed to both operate the business at the headquarters and all their clothes coming through the distribution facility. So that's essential to the business. And we're not advocating a sale and leaseback or anything like that. But in the event that from a margin of safety standpoint, if a bad environment persists, we think that could be a source of value for them. The Southbridge development, we think, has significant value. And again, they own 335 acres in a southern suburb of Charlotte called Fort Mill, South Carolina. It's right off the interstate. I think it's Interstate 77. And the road, or the overpass that goes to their subdivision, it's being redone and completed this year. So we think it'll allow a lot of easy access to companies that look to potentially headquarter there. They have completed one building on the site. It was the corporate headquarters of a company called Round Point Mortgage. Cato contributed 15 acres of land. Round Point built their headquarters. The total cost was $35 to $40 million. And Cato partnered with a North Carolina developer called Lincoln Harris in order to complete that. And they're working on getting demand for the entire subdivision. Cato and Lincoln Harris recently sold that. Cato received proceeds of just north of $3 million and booked a $2 million gain on that sale. So we think at the end of the day, through their land interest, we think there was probably some leverage that was put on that. And then Lincoln Harris did a lot of the other equity and development work. We think that can be something that's a similar model for the rest of the development, where Cato contributes the land and a developer looks to build it out. And yeah, as I mentioned, it's been considered. There aren't a lot of competing developments here. And what's happened over time is this is in the state of South Carolina. And historically, South Carolina has had a lot of incentives for businesses to come on in. And the Charlotte area has picked up kind of the competition there recently, which I think is sending eventually headquartered in Charlotte. Carolina Panthers are actually going to be in another suburb of South Carolina. But overall, a limited amount of land. We think a lot of groups are living there or relocating there. And we think it'd be a good location for hotels, offices, retail. And I think they're keeping their options open. It's not a great time to build, I think, even at this point, offices and hotels. And so a lot of the conversations they were having in the past were put on hold. But we see that abating as concerns about the pandemic slow. And we think it can be a very value creative, low risk way for the company to add value over time. So in terms of value, we value it at around $100,000 an acre for their remaining 335 acres, which is call it $33 million of value to the company. We think it could be a lot more than that, depending on how things go. But it's tough to find comparables for such a big parcel. But a lot of commercial land there trades north of $200,000 an acre for land that you can develop into hotels or retail or offices. So it's tough to tell the time frame. I think if a big corporate campus comes in, it can be monetized very quickly. But if that does not occur, we think there'll be coming up here probably a building or two that goes up each year and both allows the company to create more value off of its land and potentially monetize a good chunk of that going forward.
Perfect. So I was trying to keep track of all the numbers as you threw the sum of the parts at me, but I guess the way to think about it is right now, $16.50 or so per share, that comes out to about a $360 million market cap. $180 million of net cash on the balance sheet would take you down to $180. $30 million of tax receipt coming back takes you down to $150. $25 million tax assessed headquarters, you guys think it might be worth $50 million, but call it $25, that takes you down to $125. $30 million of value for the other acreage they own around Charlotte, that would take you down below $100. And you can see why this is so interesting to Mike, because in 2019, pre-pandemic, they did $53 million in cash flow from operations and $8 million in CapEx. So you're paying about 2x free cash flow. You know, that's after tax, after CapEx, everything, free cash flow. You're paying 2x that to the sum of the parts. Am I looking at that correctly?
Yeah, that's you summed it up really well. And as an example, in Q1, the EPS of 92 cents. Results will be volatile and it's tough to predict the back half of the year, but we think they do somewhere between $1.50 and $2.25 in EPS. And you start at a $16.50 share price after cash. You take it down to the $8 range, and after the tax refund, excluding all real estate, you're at around $6.50 net of cash. And they did 92 cents of EPS in Q1. And we think do somewhere between $1.50 and $2.25 over this fiscal year. And it seems to be trading in kind of the four times EPS type range, ex cash and the cash they expect to have coming in. So we think that's valuable or that's an attractive value to us. And I think it could be for others as well.
You know who this is in the wheelhouse for? This is Wall Street Bets. This is their wheelhouse right here. Like, retailer with a decades old history, right next to Walmart, no online sales. This is what they need. We need to get this over on Reddit real quick.
Yeah, sounds exciting. And yeah, there have been a number of retailers, and we think a lot of excitement in the retail space just on the reopening. And we've seen a number of small micro-cap retailers and that have done really well over this period, over excitement over the reopening. And Kato's done well. The stock has also performed well, but we think from a valuation standpoint, it's still looking really, really attractive versus everything.
Yep, 100%. I guess the last thing I want to touch on here, $360 million market cap, over $200 million in cash after we include the tax refund and whatever they're going to generate this quarter and everything. So over 50% of the market cap is in cash. I think we know that a lot of the capital allocation is going to go to shareholder returns, right? They pay the dividend. They're buying back stock pretty aggressively. Maybe that would change if the stock ran up a lot, but we can be pretty confident that at these levels, a lot of it's going to capital returns. But it does, you know, again, the CEO is 70. Everyone on the board, I think the youngest board member, if I'm doing this from memory, was 63 or so. So I do kind of look at this and say, hey, what is the end game for a family controlled, all physical retailer where a lot of our returns are going to be dependent on how they use this cash and what they decide to do? So if you could just touch on that for a second.
Yeah, I think the dividend is something I did touch on that you brought up as well, but pre-pandemic, they're paying 33 cents a quarter or $1.32 a year in dividends. They did stop the dividend during the pandemic. They recently reinstated at 11 cents a quarter, so 44 cents a year, or a yield just below 3%. And just in terms of use of cash, they we haven't touched on it directly, but they have too much cash on the balance sheet. I mean, they survived COVID with earning just $30 million in operating cash flow, and really don't need what comes out to be $200 million north of cash and securities.
Which, to burn $30 million during COVID, I mean, that it is unbelievable. Because remember, this is store, and yes, they have no debt, but they have 1,300 operating leases they had to pay. And you know, they were Southeastern, so they could probably open a lot sooner than we're both in the north, a lot sooner than the Northerners, but still the traffic was way down. They had to shut down to only burn $30 million. I mean, it's a credit to the management team. And it also says, hey, if in an environment when your stores really couldn't operate, if that's all you could burn, that's all you burnt, maybe you do deserve a higher multiple than 4 or 5 or 6X, whatever you're trading for right now. Sorry, that was my tangent. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And I think going forward, they used to pay a dividend that was three times as high as the one they've declared now. We think, assuming that the results come back anywhere near as strong as we think they will, that the dividend will return to somewhere in the 30 to 40 cents a quarter range, and bring that dividend yield from call it sub 3% up to 8 to 10%. And we think that provides both another investor base, but overall a return of capital. And we think the company balances out where they think the value of their stock should be with how they return capital. So again, started the repurchase program before restarting the dividend program, which we think was just they thought the stock was way, way undervalued at the time they repurchased it. So moved aggressively to do that. And in terms of kind of what the company might look like in 5 or 10 years, it's difficult to tell. What we think is kind of our base case is John Kato continues to lead the company. You mentioned kind of the tenure of the board, but the senior management of the team has been there a long time, and we think unlike, I think, a number of retail concepts where you've seen a lot of management turnover and a lot of people coming in to fix things, the team here has been very consistent over time. And a lot of the C-suite is 20-plus years of experience all at Kato. So we think there are people there that can take over in terms of what occurs should John Kato not be there anymore. It's difficult to tell, but we think from an operating standpoint, they're still in good hands. And from an operations standpoint, if they want to continue on the path they are, they're
needing an influx of new talent in order to do that.
Yeah. The only thing I was going to add there is they had a chart in their proxy, average years of service by position. And I was pretty struck, you know, the average for a sales associate, the average years of service is 2 years, which strikes me as pretty high for kind of a mall-based retailer to have 2 years of average tenure just at the sales associate. And then it goes way up from there. Store manager, 6 years, district manager, 15, the C-suite is, you know, 10 plus. So yeah, I was really struck by the length of tenure of just the employees and stuff. I never know if that's probably at the C-suite, it's probably a good sign. I never know if it's a good sign or a bad sign, but I was just impressed by it. It struck me as atypical for a retailer.
Yeah, and they have the promote from within mentality. I think they say 80% of their management is promoted from within. And I think they like to build the culture and train people the way they want to train people. So I think it creates a, I don't want to say a family, but a group of employees that know the company well and know who their customer is and wants to serve that customer.
Yeah, and just bringing it back to management. So Cato is 70. It sounds to me like what you're saying is your feel is he wants to run this for a while. And even if he's not, the management team behind him, they're going to keep this going. There's no, you know, because you see a CEO who's 70, owns a lot of stock. My first thought also goes to succession planning. Is he going to look to sell this to private equity, sell this to a bigger buyer? He's 70, which is young in the corporate world, but, you know, it's always in the back of your mind.
Yeah, I think both of those are options. Our base case is he wants to stay on probably as long as he feels he's able to. And I think kind of growing up in the industry, it's what kind of his namesake company that base case is he'll want to be in control and be at the helm for as long as he's able to physically go to work. So, we don't see anything changing there. And feel comfortable with how he's allocated capital before that he's going to do it in a way that's beneficial to all shareholders.
Perfect. Look, I think we've hit just about everything I had in the notes on Cato. It's nice, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in studying the latest synthetic biotech company coming public at a $10 billion valuation. But I was enjoying myself reading, you know, it's a pretty simple 10K. They didn't even have earnings calls, so I didn't have to go read the earnings calls transcripts. It's pretty simple company. But anything else you think we should be talking about with Cato?
Yeah, I think you hit on a good thing there in terms of they're not a promotional company. And so maybe others want to promote it. And maybe I'm doing that here today. But
that's your job. That's why you're coming on the podcast.
Yeah, no earnings calls, really no IR presentations or anything like that. So I think they can fly under the radar for a lot of people. Our history on the company from a team standpoint, we followed them since probably 2017 or 2018. And in 2018, my colleague Nick Bodner, who has really led a lot of our process there. So I have to give a shout out to Nick and all the work he's done there. But we went down and visited their headquarters and just in terms of our investment process, especially pre-pandemic, we made a point to go and see and meet people whenever possible and see the facilities and see the land holdings. So we went down there. We were very impressed. The corporate headquarters looks new. It's a nice building. We had a good meeting with the team and then went to their two land holdings. So we went down to the Southbridge development and I should go into it a little bit more, but it's the former home of the Charlotte Knights minor league baseball team. And so they bought that out of bankruptcy for $10 million or so in 2012 and just kind of held on to it. And then announced plans to kind of move forward with their own development. But Daimler Chrysler has an office building there. There's a school not far away. And from a development standpoint, we think it's a good area for a corporate campus. And it looked like a place where people would want to live and work. So that made it exciting to us, especially in a growing area. And the other land holding that we really don't value as well, it's 185 acres in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And that's where the Carolina Panthers are relocating to. And they've got 185 acres there. We think that's just a land bank for them now. And there are a couple other distribution facilities there, again, right by the interstate. And it's we don't think that's going to be monetized in the near term as they keep that as an option for future expansion, but it's there and it has value. So that's the point we try to make, is go and see stuff in our visit. Kind of led us to believe that there's a lot of land and property value and a good management team in place. And just in terms of our process, we as the pandemic struck, we took a really close look at it and fell below kind of our target of where we wanted to own the company at, and probably got in a little too soon, but then looked at as it fell further, and thought just from an asset value standpoint, we gained a lot of comfort in the concept and in their land holdings and assets. And that was kind of our process as we moved through our diligence process that started a few years ago to purchasing where we're at now.
That's perfect. You know what I like about that story? I do love that you guys had visited it. Like, this is one thing I've tried to tell people, like a lot of investing to me is you've done the work and then something crazy happens, right? And because you've already done the work, and in your case, you had visited the company in 2018, probably not expecting a global pandemic that shuts down the whole country, but you know, you've done the work, something crazy happens, the stock drops 20%, or the stock's up 10, but you've done the work and you know the stock dropped 20% and it should have gone up 4, or it goes up 10, but you've already done the work and this news comes out and you say, this should be up 100% on this news. And a lot of investing to me is like, the windows can be pretty brief, and I'm not saying this is the only way to invest, right? But a lot of times the big alpha is where you've done the work. There's a 2-day window where the market thinks this is one thing and you think this is another. Obviously, this was a pandemic, it's different, but you had done the work before. Let me ask you two quick questions to follow up on what you said. You mentioned our talk on AXR. You guys obviously like to do a lot of in-person diligence of companies. I do as well. I have not since the COVID. I'm just asking in general for my knowledge. Have you guys started visiting companies again? Have y'all find them receptive to seeing investors?
Yeah, we've started the process within the last month or two, and it's a tricky process, as you don't there's still a lot of health precautions you want to take, both for our team and then also for everyone we're visiting. So once we were vaccinated, and in the event that the companies we're visiting are comfortable with in-person visitors, we try to be just very respectful and make sure they know, or we know going into it, what their expectations are and what their office setting is. For the most part, we've done call it 3 to 5 over the last month, so we've tried to pick it up. But there've been good visits. I think companies have been appreciative of showing interest, and I think overall, especially for firms that have taken the approach that a lot of us are in the office, it's refreshing to see people and to get out and interact again. So it's been nice to do that. And it's been something we just recently started.
Yeah. I haven't started visiting, but I've just started going back, you know, meeting lots of friends at bars and stuff. And it's nice, but you do kind of get that, where do I put my arms? Where do I put my hands? I'm not used to being around people anymore. More company specific question. You mentioned that they own another 183 acres, I think you said, of land next to where the Panthers are moving. Is that the Panthers' new stadium, or is that the Panthers' new headquarters?
It's their new corporate headquarters. So they like to relocate, I think, a year or two back. And so the stadium's staying, but I think it'll be a new practice facility and corporate headquarters for the team. And that brings with it a fair amount of tourism and visitors and things like that. So along with that, while the Panthers' new facility is in the 185 acres that Cato owns, we do think it will bring a lot of activity. I think the price tag of the whole thing, or the economic impact, was $2 billion that was expected. So we think that it certainly can't hurt for land prices in the area.
No, I was just wondering, because headquarters and practice facility are really nice. Obviously, that's going to bring money and stuff around, but if you're talking, if there was a new stadium getting built, right, we're talking just huge fortunes. I'm not aware of too many, but you can make a lot of money. The Atlanta Braves, they've got all that. Liberty Braves, they've got all that land around the new SunTrust Stadium. I mean, that land, they are making so much money of it because people love to live near ballparks and stadiums.
Yeah, it's a good clarification of the stadium is not located there, but yeah, we think especially kind of in the current environment, people like to be or have increasingly looked to be where stadiums are. And you've seen a lot of redevelopment in cities next to big tourist locations that draw people in. So we'll see our thought is that kind of returns post-pandemic when people feel comfortable being in crowds again. But that was certainly a trend beforehand. And we think we'll go back to that as well. So, we agree with that.
Perfect. Well, hey, Mike, this was great. It's a good, simple value investment. And I mean that in the best way, right? Like you can read the 10K, you can make a decision. Great capital returns here, very cheap multiple. And you even threw in some little spicy extras that I like that I hadn't even seen on a first glance with the tax refund, the land and all that. So this is great. Mike, thank you so much for coming back on. It was wonderful having you and looking forward to having you on for the third time.
Hey, Andrew, great to see you again. Thanks for the interest in the questions, and happy to help with any questions for any listeners that might be out there on Cato or anything else.
So, and how can listeners reach you? I think I've got your contact info in the last podcast. I'll be sure to include it, but how would you like people to reach you? The Gate City website?
That has a link to our kind of corporate email. That's fine. Or if people want to email me directly, I'm okay with that too. It's MLB, which is MMELBY @gatecitycap.com.
Perfect. Well, if you listen this far, you've got his personal email address. If not, I'll have the link to the Gate City website in the show notes. But Mike, thanks again for coming on. Looking forward to chatting soon.
Hey, great seeing you. Thanks again.